Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
It's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Jeffrey Wallen, President Emeritus and Founder of the American Academy for Liberal Education. Back to the show. Jeff is a nationally known Churchill scholar. We're going to talk about Winston Churchill today. He has background that he served at the National Endowment for the Humanities. He was Program Director at the Robert M. Hunchin Center for the Study of Democracy. He taught at the University of Dallas and the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he went to Claremont Graduate University. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dale. Good to speak with you.
Well, after our last discussion about Churchill and the film The Darkest Hour, it got so interesting that I asked you to come back on and let's talk more about Winston Churchill, this remarkable man who arguably saved Europe from fascism. Do you think that's too broad a statement?
Oh, no. Look, I mean, obviously you could never say one man did it. Intention without arms is not going to lead to success. And so there were many factors that led to it, not least of which was that Hitler didn't always make the right decisions. He didn't decide to conquer one great nation at a time. He went both east and west at the same time. So many, many different things. But remember this. Churchill was convinced that the nature of reality was such that one could never guarantee success. That would imply a kind of materialism that would make human freedom impossible. But that freedom that's there means that one can hope for and one can do everything imaginable to guarantee success without guaranteeing it, but therefore one can deserve it. I hope that's not too theoretical.
No, you're allowed one distinction.
Okay.
So I always tell politicians when they're campaigning, they're allowed one distinction, but beyond that, people won't follow them. I have been, because of you, I've been reading one of the great biographies of Winston Churchill, the one by Roy Jenkins,
yes,
which is just marvelous. And I've read through the early life up until about 1905, 1906. From what I could tell, if he had died in 1905, he would have had a full life.
Yes, remember that he wrote his autobiography in the 30s, all right? My early life, a roving commission.
Well, he certainly had a lot to write about.
He did. I mean, he'd fought in at least three wars I can think of. He'd written several books, many of them very profound, good books. Some of them more a matter of correspondence of the sort that you get in good newspapers. But he had done an awful lot by very early age, and so that when he was out of office in the 30s. He not only despaired about that, of course, as any man of action would, but he also could look back and say that he had not thrown his life away. He'd done a great deal. He set much in motion, whether it be in domestic policy or foreign policy.
I don't think I've read the biography of anyone who was as driven to not just to success, but public recognition or what would be called honor as Winston Churchill.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, these days we tend not to speak much of honor, or we tend to think that that is something that's old-fashioned. But in an older understanding of the same universe we live in, which hasn't changed at all, honor is the point at which honest and decent men can hang their hat as a point of reference for getting through the unknown future. And for Churchill, it was a very real thing. He really thought in many cases that the failures of men were failures not of intelligence, but of moral sturdiness, and therefore failures of honor, a failure to recognize that the world contained references for honor and to act on them. Or, to put it in a very simple way, that as a philosopher, you will very clearly understand, Churchill really did believe that there was nature and there was human nature, and knowing those things, you could guide your life to live well. Again, you couldn't guarantee success. Nobody can do that. But he thought that the universe was so constructed that even though we didn't choose it that way, it lay out there, and if you could recognize that and lead your life according to it, you had at least a good chance.
So he was a Victorian.
Worth having. Yes, he was a Victorian. But so what?
Well, I mean, the Victorians believed in that.
Oh, no, they didn't. Are you kidding? A lot of them did, but a lot of them didn't. You had Marxism, you had socialism.
I'm not thinking of Darwinists. And I'm thinking now of this kind of solid Christian Platonic worldview that still existed at the time, say, of Queen Victoria.
Oh, yes. No, that's true. Churchill was more thoughtful about that than many.
Aha.
When it was put to the test, he could stand up to the test. A lot of people didn't. You know, there's a wonderful play by Bernard Shaw. You may remember, I've forgotten it. But there's a household party, as there almost always was in a play by Shaw. And a young man is walking through the woods. And he hears a young damsel cry out for help. Someone is trying to attack her and rob her or something like that. And this young man comes just charging along and breaks up the thing and chases the other fellow off. And she's very thankful. She says, oh, my God, you endangered yourself, all of this. And he just looks at her and says, well, what else could one do? I mean, that was the standard of morality that you're talking about. And that is a deeply internalized but not necessarily reflective kind of honor. Churchill had that, but he also wrote things that teach us that he understood the deeper meaning of it and why it was important and why it was important to rally people to it. Remember, he wasn't just trying to save his homeland. He was trying to save the highest aspirations of the West. You know, not to see that would be not to understand him as he understood himself.
And by the way, let's talk about his parents. He had an American mother, correct? And he had an aristocratic father.
Oh, yes. Well, he came from an aristocratic family. As you know, he was the grandson of a duke.
And he was half from the British aristocracy and half from the American successful bourgeoisie.
Yeah, meritocracy, you might say. Yes.
And who had the most influence on young Winston?
Well, I think his father had an incredible influence on him.
That would be Lord Randolph.
Yeah, it often is the case when one's father is distant or dies early. Think, for example, of Patton, raised by his mother. Hero worshipped his father. Churchill was a bit like that. But he loved his mother, although he said, I had to admire her from afar like a Chinese star. Because, again, she was so busy in her social life and so on. And, of course, they didn't raise children then the way we raise them now, close to us. And, they sent them off to school at age six or eight. And so it was a different kind of upbringing. And not one he was very happy with, by the way. He was a very lonely young man when he was sent off to Harrow. And
he was miserable.
He sent these pleading letters to his mother and father to come and see him. I mean, they hurt you when you read them. And he didn't very often get a response. Well, if he did get a response, it was of this sort. Winston, this cannot continue. You are wasting too much money again. You know, we cannot be here for you just to pull you out of trouble all the time. Because he was a pretty headstrong kid. But he was lonely, and he was determined to pick up on his father's failed life. Remember, the Lord Randolph was a very well-known politician. He became
Exchequer.
The British word. And which usually the next stepping stone is to be prime minister. But he did some foolish things politically and lost office and never got it back again. And so one of Churchill's early books is a two-volume biography of his father, where, of course, his father is treated as a truly great man and everyone else doesn't recognize that greatness. But that's certainly part of the motivating drive behind him, is to capture the Churchill name and to bring it to the point that he thought his father was taking it to. And that's a very strong pole to steer by for such an ambitious young man.
So he was basically on his own at a very early age.
Yes.
And did he go from Harrow to Sandhurst?
Yes. Yes.
Tell our listeners the difference between these kinds of schools. Sandhurst was a military school, correct?
Yes, it was. It was sort of like our West Point.
Yeah.
That's the closest you could say of it. And there were only a few respectable professions open to young men at that time. You could go into the clergy. You could go into foreign policy, diplomatic corps, things of that sort. You could go into business, of course, although it was somewhat looked down upon. And mainly that meant you either went to Oxford or Cambridge on the one hand, or you went to the military academy. And Churchill went to the military academy, where he became not only a soldier, but a horseman, a great horseman.
He was a polo player.
Yes, he played polo up until his 50s. And he was a member of the championship polo team in India when he was over there as a young man.
Well, let's follow him. Let's follow him a bit. He graduated from Sandhurst.
Yes.
And where was his first assignment?
Well, he first went to India, that part of the empire. But very early on, he went to Cuba as a correspondent. That's one of the things you have to bear in mind about his early life, is that he spent 5 years in an active military, but he also was working for various newspapers to make money. And so he would get a commission from a newspaper to go someplace and write. He did that on Cuba, and he met the head of the expeditionary force going to Cuba and was told to act as a spy, to try and find out what the British needed to know about a new Spanish bullet that was being used in the war.
And so he is writing then sort of professionally from the very beginning, or is he simply a spy masquerading as a journalist?
No, I mean, his whole career was based on journalism, really,
right.
Journalism and politics. And the spy business meant that he had a reason to be there. And when I say spy, I don't mean the intrigue and all that. He was meant to find out what this new bullet was like, what kind of damage it can do, and so the military needed to know that. So in that sense, it was spying.
So he also
not
then...
in the sense that we're thinking about.
After Cuba, he spent some time in New York City, correct?
Yes, he did. He did. And he had a great time, although he did get hit by a motor car after a while, had to deal with that. But that was a very influential time for him because his mother introduced him by a letter to various people she knew, and one of them was Burke Cochran, who was a very well-known politician. And Cochran more or less took young Winston under his wing and gave him a lot of advice of how to proceed, since they both knew that what he wanted to do was go into politics.
Well, he's in his early 20s at this point. He's been on his own through public school and then the military academy at Sandhurst. He then is off to Cuba as a second lieutenant in the 4th Hussars, correct?
He was attached. He was attached at that time to a different group. He was in the 4th Hussars, but even if you try to follow that, it changes as he gets different appointments in order to get onto a battlefield.
So he then in 1895, he's 21. Mm-hmm. He goes off to Cuba. Then he goes into New York City, but in 1896, he's in Bombay, India.
That's right.
And what's he doing there?
Well, that's only on his way up north, actually, because of the wars that they fought in India, holding on to the empire. And that usually had to do with the area of Pakistan, Afghanistan, India, that whole area. Of course, Pakistan wasn't what it is now. That was part of India at the time. But anyway, that general area to the northwest, that's where they were sent because that's where the border wars were. That's where the rebellions.
And what kind of wars were these? I mean, were these the kind of wars like were they fighting like civil war type of weaponry and so forth?
The weaponry was something like that, yes. and they were. They were an odd kind of war deal because they were unequal wars in many ways. That is to say that the Indians mostly didn't have modern weapons. And there are several times where Churchill talks about just holding a line with Maxims or for machine guns, and the enemy is advancing toward them either on foot or on horseback. It's a very unequal contest.
That's
which
pretty sad.
Churchill and many others as a conflict between civilization and barbarism.
And they were just mowing down folks as they attacked them.
It was awful. They were getting mowed down. Now, he praises their courage. It's interesting. Churchill didn't see these people in the same way some of his colleagues did. That is just, you know, they're these heathen types, and they don't deserve to live anyway. He admired their physical courage, even though some what it was based upon he didn't believe in. But he admired them as an enemy. But the same thing, by the way, kind of happened to the British themselves in a war of War of One. And that is that they had to throw themselves against
the
French.
Oh, yeah, the Battle of the Somme.
And by machine guns.
50,000 casualties in the first one day. I happen to be reading a book on the Battle of the Somme right now.
Isn't that unbelievable?
I
saw that post deal, and I want to mention something to you about that, but we can do that later.
Okay. How did it come about that Churchill took part in the last cavalry charge?
Oh, yes. Well, that was... he was... I'm trying to get my thoughts exactly right here because the dates are a little confusing. But that was... Remember the battle for Khartoum? The British had suffered a grievous defeat under Lord Kitchener.
Now, we're down in Africa now.
Yeah, that was under Gordon. And Churchill was one of the people dispensed to carry on the fighting there. And then in the Northwest Frontier, they were just continual battles all along the river. You know, he wrote the Malakin Field Force. He wrote the River War. I mean, Churchill was just writing all the time about all of
the wars. Was writing for the Pioneer and the Daily Telegraph.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one of the things to take out of that, it seems to me, is I am simply stunned by the amount of work that man produced.
Right.
Because here he was over there in India and Egypt and so on, extremely hot. No, there's an air conditioner or anything. It's really a brutal kind of life, even though they have people taking care of them and all of that.
So it was it was in 1898 that he left Bangalore and went down to join Kitchener.
Right, right.
And that's
a very interesting war. That's the one I was talking about, more than the ones in India. And the reason it's more interesting, I think, is that there's more at stake there in a certain sense. There's a civilization against non-civilization. And later on, India becomes much more interesting when Churchill has to deal with it as part of his colonial duties. And then the question is, do you hold on to the empire or not? Is it a civilizing empire or is it not? And at the same time, you've got him down there in Africa for the Boer War.
So it's along the Nile that this cavalry charge takes place against the Sudanese army.
Right, right. And
the Battle of Omdurman, is that how you pronounce
Omdurman,
it?
Omdurman, right. And what happened is a group of men, the group that Churchill was in, got cut off from the main body. All right, and they thought that there were just a few of the enemy on the other side of the hill. And so they trotted up there, and there was a huge number of soldiers facing them. And a pretty good ambush, actually. And Churchill writes that there really wasn't much decision to make. You just had to pull your sword, or in his case, his pistol, because he'd injured his shoulder playing polo. Charge. Yeah. So he used his pistol.
With me, I would have had a golf club in my hand or something.
Yes, right. Yeah, you hit it pretty wicked with a golf club. Might have worked with you. So they did this charge. They lost about 25% of the men in the charge. It was really two charges.
Did they win the charge, or was it a standoff?
Yeah, they tore through, and it was vicious. You know, they're fighting men, trying to pull them off horses, and stabbing, shooting, and everything. And they get through that mass of men. And then they wheel their ponies around and charge right back through again. And Churchill uses that as an occasion to talk about bravery and what civilized bravery is like, as opposed to just getting yourself all worked up, you know, gung-ho, without thinking too much.
Did he not fear death?
Well, I think any man fears death, but in the heathen moment, no, I don't think he did. That was not only because of the heathen moment. I shouldn't say it. That makes it sound like just because his blood was up, which is partly true. But the other part was he believed that fate was on his side.
Yes.
He was meant for a better thing.
Right.
Than dying.
He knew his time had not come. Not for a long, long time.
He wrote a letter to his mother, which I don't have right here, but it was really a wonderful letter about how he had ridden his old gray pony back and forth along the lines in within easy range of the opposing gunfire. And he recognized how dangerous it was, but he said, I'm not playing for small stakes. you know, he was thinking of his future and of the medals he would win to help propel him into politics. But he also believed that the fate was on his side, and that unless he was really stupid, he wouldn't have to pay the ultimate price for that.
So he's 25 years old in 1899. He writes a book called The River War about that particular campaign.
Yeah.
And he goes back to England, and he wants to stand for Parliament. What happens?
Mm-hmm. Well, he didn't do well standing for Parliament originally. It was a by-election that he stood for in Oldham. And he didn't win, nor did the partner that was running with him win. They were running a couple of candidates for the Tories. And so he didn't win that. And he ran in another one. He didn't win that. And it took him a little while to get into politics. It was perfectly normal stuff. And it's hard for Americans to understand British politics because the constituencies, many of the constituencies, were really governed by large landowners. And they had it within their power to more or less give a constituency to somebody.
Right.
But when Churchill finally went in, he represented the Manchester area. And that was a very democratic type.
And listeners should know that you did not have to have any association with the area that you ran.
Yes,
with.
That's right, too.
You could run for any parliamentary office.
Yeah. It's kind of confusing, but it's true.
Yeah.
So they would stand for these districts. And sometimes when a politician lost, the party would just put him in another constituency, maybe a safer one, where everybody from that party was likely to get elected. So that's how it was done. It was just a very different kind of system. They finally got rid of what they called the rotten boroughs a few years later. Rotten boroughs because they originally had a lot of voters, but what with the Industrial Revolution and all, some of them were down to, you know, 50 people or something like that to vote. You could control them pretty easily. So this was all taking place at the time when there's constitutional change in England. And Churchill, early on, even though he's a Tory, a conservative.
He's born into a Tory family.
Yes, right. But he also is very progressive. And he stood for what his father had called Tory democracy. And that meant that he was very much for alleviating the ills faced by ordinary people. Remember, at this time, you could be very hardworking man tried to hold together your family, and one bout of illness could cost you your job. That would be it. You'd be thrown in the poorhouse.
Right. And they had a poorhouse in those days.
Oh, yeah, really. And that's why Churchill changed parties and became a liberal. And he and Lloyd George, who was the radical of his times, they created job exchanges. They created minimum care standards and things like that to put, as we often say in this country, a social net underneath people under which they can't fall. The state will take care of them enough to get them back on their feet. Churchill helped introduce all of that.
He finally won a seat in 1900, correct?
Yeah, right.
And he's on the way. I mean, as Roy Jenkins put it, he's fulfilling what he sees as his destiny.
Yeah.
And he had to get elected to Parliament. And he's got this, he's already created a kind of profile of a military hero.
Yes.
But after the break, we'll talk about the Boer War, which he really established himself as a national hero there. We'll talk about that.
He came home to huge crowds.
But, so he's part Tory, part liberal. And doesn't he eventually go back to the Tory Party?
Yes.
When does he do that?
This created a lot of problems for him, of course, because in England, being a party man meant being a man of principle, not somebody just out for yourself, but out for the views of your party and all. So Churchill changed parties twice, and that didn't help him when it came to people who trusted him. A lot of them thought he was just pushy, out for his own, and didn't care for the larger good. That wasn't really true. That's certainly not how he saw it. But it's something he had to deal with later in life.
Now, for those of our listeners who think, well, Churchill's in Parliament now, so he's staying in England, and he's going to be a politician, that's not the case, because he witnesses the outbreak of the Second Boer War, and he wants to be part of it. Now, tell our listeners, we have just 2 minutes left before we break, what is the Boer War?
Well, the Boer War was in Africa, in South Africa, And it would, there were various groups of people dominating that area besides the Africans themselves. There were the Dutch, and they were the Boers. And then there were the English, and they were another part of that same territory. And what happened is, it happened many times, it happened here in this country, there was a gold strike. And that gold strike changed the temper of things. All of a sudden, that became very valuable property. The Boers did not want to let the incoming British have any kind of voting rights or anything of that sort. And then a war broke out between the two of them because of that. And Churchill was very active in that war. But there's a part of it you have to recall because it played against him as well. When he came back as a hero from the war, because, as you know...
We'll talk about that after the break. Let's let our listeners wonder what we're going to talk about. Go ahead.
Got it.
But does he go as a journalist or does he go as a military man?
Well, that's an open question. He went as a journalist, but he fought when he had to. He fought saving a train that was being captured by the Boers. And because of that, when he was captured, he was treated as a combatant. But he claimed that he was just a journalist. And frankly, he tried to have it both ways. So what he wanted to do.
It's interesting that wherever he went in his early life, he was part military man, part journalist, and now part politician.
Yeah.
Talking with Dr. Jeffrey Wallen, Churchill scholar, longtime friend of mine. We'll be back after this break.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is the telephone a problem in your home? Is there a lot of talking and listening going on at your expense? The telephone is a youngster's link to the outside world where the action is really happening, not in your house. The phone's appeal is enormous. Therefore, its potential for abuse is enormous. So we parents have to decree phone limits, because the average child won't. To relieve some phone fights, parents will get the kids their own phone. I think this is a problem. First of all, who pays for the phone? Second, it opens the lines to longer communications. Third, do siblings get their own? Fourth, will you ever see your child again? Maybe you could get her call waiting. Now, speaking of call waiting, some parents do this, but then again, that just kind of shifts the problem. It essentially says, Polly, you go ahead and talk on with your 97 friends, but let me know if either of my two friends call. Maybe there's a few other things we can do. How about a phone time? Say from 4 to 4:30, Polly can get calls, and from 8 to 8:30. Now, she's responsible for sending out a notice in the paper to all her friends that those are her phone times. Phone time can be earned. In other words, you have to do X minutes of chores to earn X minutes of phone time. Another mother solved the problem this way. She put one phone in the kitchen. The kids had conversations. Mom was usually around. Phones are nowhere near as much fun when the folks are there listening in. I'm Dr. Ray.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
I'm back with Dr. Jeff Wallen, who is a Winston Churchill scholar, and we're talking about the life of Winston Churchill. And Jeff's already said several times, sometimes it's hard to tease out the exact chronology of this remarkable young man who, by the age of 25, had done so much, been to so many places, and was rising to stardom so quickly. And just to clarify, the first time he ran for Parliament, he was defeated in 1899. It was then that he got on a boat and went down as a journalist representing the Daily Mail and Morning Post to Cape Town. And he got involved, as Jeff said, militarily, because he always seemed to be wearing both hats. And it was after he comes back to the Boer War in 1900 as a war hero that he is finally elected to Parliament. Now, Jeff, tell our listeners the story of how did Winston Churchill become a war hero?
Oh, well, first of all, what led to the capture is he was on a train going in South Africa, and the train was stopped by Boer forces. Okay, they blew up the crackle that knocked some trains off. Churchill immediately took charge of everything, unhooked back part of the train so we could get back to where they came from, and then fought off the troops, got the engineer who'd been wounded back into a cab to go, and then was captured. It's an interesting case that there's some confusion about that. He thought he was captured by the man who then became a head of the board, head of the South African government. And he may have been, or it may have been that Defoe was just, leading up the troops against him. That we don't know for sure. Churchill seems to be a little confused on that. But it's interesting, nevertheless, because he always considered Botha, who I'm talking about, to be a close friend of his. And that lasted through the Second World War. It was very useful to Churchill.
Well, Churchill did tend to inflate his achievements, did he not?
Well, he did, but on the other hand, they're real achievements. In other words, he probably thought that he found out later on that when he met Botha, Botha said, "Oh, I was there." You know, that may have meant I was in command. Churchill took it to mean he was the lone horseman with a rifle aimed at Churchill that Churchill surrendered to.
How did he escape? How did he escape the POW camp?
Yeah, well, there was a group of young men, and they escaped from the fence, and it was quite a wild ride after that. He was chased throughout South Africa, and he was with a couple of others at the beginning, but soon was just on his own, and he had to hide out in trains with tarpaulins over him. And, of course, the Boers had really wanted to get him back because he was well-known, and they didn't want him escaping. So they really called out everybody to get after him. And he had a tremendous piece of luck. He was out there with almost nothing around. He saw a farmhouse in the distance, and he went up to it. It turned out that they were sympathizing with the British, and they hid him in a barn for a day or two and then helped him get on a train and hide there. Until
I thought he hid within the mine, with a mine.
It was a mine.
Down a mine shaft.
It was a mine, yeah. Yeah.
So he really did have a great story to tell when he got back to England.
Oh, yeah, he did. And, of course, everybody's heard about it by then. He gets back, and there are pictures of him on the back platform of trains, speaking, giving speeches and everything. And it was a huge boost to his career, exactly what he was looking for. But, again, there was a lot of danger. They could have found him at any minute. And he tells the story how close they came on several occasions to getting him.
But before he went to England, returned to England, he actually formally entered the British military and fought against the Boers.
That's right. That's right. Trying to think about the exact timing of that, I would probably be a little off.
It was all during the year 200. This all happened during the year, 1900.
Yeah.
All within this remarkable year. You could write a whole book on the year 1900 in Winston Churchill's life.
Right, and this huge change, everything in England's changing, everything in Europe is changing as the new century comes in. People tend to look at that area, the Victorian area, as very peaceful and calm. And, of course, comparison to times at war, it was, and comparison to some of the later times, it was. But it was a time of upheaval, too. There were a lot of labor unrest, strikes, national strikes.
Look what's going on in Russia.
Socialism, communism. Yeah. All that was going on.
The build-up to the Russian Revolution, the build-up to the first revolution in 1905.
That's right.
So he goes...
Too bad that one didn't succeed, I've always thought.
I know, it would have been much kinder.
Yeah, because Lenin and Stalin were part of that one.
That's right. So he stands for Parliament again for the seat of Oldham.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, according to Roy Jenkins, his escape from the Boers was across the front page of papers for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
He was a national celebrity.
He really was. He was a darling of England at that time.
Because they were looking for good news about that war, because that war wasn't going well.
Right. And he only did one thing that put him in a bad light, and it was just part of his honesty. He once said early on there, he said, if I were a Boer, I would be fighting on the Boer side, which seems like a pretty reasonable thing. But a lot of people took issue with that and thought that he was claiming that the Boers were right in this land dispute and everything, which is not what he meant. What he meant was he always recognized the courage of his opponents. And he recognized that he was fighting because he was British. And the Boers were fighting because they were the Dutch South Africans. And he didn't try to make it into a situation where they were naturally evil and his side was naturally good. But it did get him in some trouble.
So at the age of 26, he's elected to Parliament. Mm-hmm. And he also begins to write a two-volume biography of his father, Lord Randolph Churchill. What an amazing guy.
Yeah. You know, Deal, we should just mention one thing in passing, which this leads anyone hearing us to understand. And that is Churchill's amazing capacity for work. You know, he headed up every department there was to head up. I think maybe one or two he didn't. And he was always a great success at them because he had this immense capacity for work, for mastering detail, and for getting things done. He would reorganize department when he went into it and just get it crackling. Same thing when he went to write books. Whatever it was, he may have had a large and capacious mind with his eye on the distant future in many ways, but he knew the here and now and made it his own. And that's part of his great success, I think.
Now, he wouldn't get married till 1908 to Clementine.
Right.
And, of course, Clementine, and we don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but she plays a very important role in his life. Maybe, go ahead. Address that.
Well, she does. Well, she does. I
mean, they met in 1904, which is about the time we're talking about.
Right.
And she herself comes from what kind of background?
Well, she comes from upper class in New York City. Her father was a well-known and successful, and sometimes unsuccessful, stockbroker. And he also was well-known in racing circles. I think he started at least two jockey clubs. But his fortune, like many fortunes at that time, went up and down, depending on when the market crashed and all that. But Jerome, the father, was very well-known. And
but she was born in London. Wasn't she an American raised in England?
No, she was raised in America.
Okay.
Now, she spent some time in Paris as a young lady in France, but that was, you know, typical of an upper-class education and way of life. But she was very much an American, and that was a great combination. And, you know, you learn a lot by reading old people like Charlotte and Jane Austen and so on about how these great families operated. And what happened is you had, in the case of Churchill, it comes from a noble line, and I'm headed up by a duke, but not having a great deal of money because the last couple of dukes have pretty well just thrown it all away, which happens, just to face it. And then marry into a rich American family who would like to have some aristocratic pretension. And that's what came about. So it was a good marriage and a very stable marriage. And there were many times in the marriage where Clementine was really useful to Churchill partly by calming him sometimes. He was very impetuous. Maybe that's the wrong word. That sounds kind of petty. I just mean, you know, headstrong. And she would warn him of some of the pitfalls if he gave that kind of speech rather than another one, things of that sort.
Well, they were married 56 years.
Yeah.
How many kids did they have?
Let's see. They had
five.
Two sons, two daughters. Five altogether. Yeah.
And the films that we'll discuss later, the films of the war years, World War II, show that Clementine was really an essential part of Churchill's success as prime minister during the war. Is that too bold a statement?
Well, hard to say. You know, as prime minister, she wasn't that involved in running the country or anything like that. But he couldn't have been Churchill as he was without Clementine. I'm not sure how to nail it down more than that. But she was absolutely essential to his way of life and to his equanimity. And she had good judgment. There were times when she fought on his behalf with other politicians who wanted to write him off because they were mad, you know, because of the Dardanelles situation or something like that. And so she was very, very helpful. Everybody liked her and respected her. And she wasn't, you know, frivolous or anything of that sort. She was a lovely woman. And it's marvelous reading their letters, by the way. He would call her his Kit Kat. And It's amazing how these wonderful, powerful men on the world stage turn into little boys when writing letters to their wives, their girlfriends. It was a lovely relationship. It really was.
Well, he spends 11 years in Parliament, like you say, sort of being a man of the people in many sort of unpredictable ways. But then he becomes appointed First Lord of the Admiralty in 1911.
Before going there, I think we ought to discuss a little bit about what he was doing before he became First Lord, because it's a big, big part of his life. And that's when he changed. He crossed over the aisle, and he became a liberal, and he became involved with social politics, and therefore thrown in the fight against socialism, and he was brilliant in it. Churchill had never got over his view that the real problem with socialism, even though he wanted to make the lives of the masses much better, the problem with socialism, he thought, is that it's fundamentally materialistic. Right? And he was devoted to higher principles, and he wanted the people of England devoted to higher principles, not just a question of how much food there is to eat and all that sort of thing. That was very important to him, and he did what he could. He reformed the prisons and made them more decent and so on. But he thought that the socialists treated human beings as just, as materialists did.
Mechanistic.
People with no higher ambitions, with no souls, just a question of a few pence more in the paycheck or not.
Now, is this why he backed free trade as much as he did?
What's that?
Is this why he was such a strong backer of free trade?
Yes. His view on free trade was that the real issue with it was freedom. And what he didn't like about free trade, because he didn't, he supported it for a long, long time, is that he wanted to make sure that it really benefited the workers as well. You know what it reminds me of a little bit is when Trump was originally running his campaign, it sounded like he was against free trade. But then he said, no, I'm not against it, but I want it to be fair, too.
Right.
And Churchill thought that some of the old aristocrats who owned some of the factories and so on, that they wanted to use trade too much to keep the masses in their place. And he didn't want that. He was very much for them. And he would get in these arguments with the socialists, you know, Beatrice Webb and Stanley Webb and so on, because it was a deep matter of principle to him. The point was that either the state, or as he put it, either you own the state or the state owns you. If the state owns you, it can take care of your material needs.
Which precisely what happened in Russia and Nazi Germany.
Exactly. Exactly.
And then he had to make a deal with the devil to beat the Germans.
Yeah, wasn't that a wonderful phrase?
We're going to talk about that.
If the devil invaded hell, I would at least make a favorable reference to him.
So what does a First Lord of the Admiralty actually do? And
look,
this is, of course, just prior to the breaking out of the First World War.
Right. Well, he is responsible for the welfare of the Navy. You know, he's a civilian minister. He has three sea lords under him who carry out the actual running of the Navy. And he sets policy with the rest of the cabinet, of course, and runs it sort of like Secretary of Defense. And, of course, being Churchill, he threw himself very actively into it. He was responsible, along with some of the subordinates, and early on seeing the importance of moving transforming the fleet into a coal-burning fleet, oil-burning fleet, from a coal-burning fleet. And that made a huge difference to his ability to survive.
He was always keyed in on technology, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah. He loved technology and always pushed it very, very hard. It's funny that he did because he had so many reservations about technology, as you can see from his essays, Mass Effects of Modern Life and others, where he talks about what science can do to belittle man and, remove his soul from him in a way. So he understood all the serious dangers. But in war, he always thought that the brilliance of a great leader shows itself up in fewer casualties and more victories, not victories based upon his willingness to take many, many casualties. And the reason for that is, once again, he thought that one of the big enemies of his whole age with this materialism, modern materialism. He wanted to save a place for human direction, for the human soul to give direction to man's activities.
Human dignity.
You can do that. You can do that if you can maneuver and save lives and win, rather than just throwing another army at the guy and fighting it out to the last man standing.
He also was a big proponent of air power.
Oh, yes, very much so. Very much so. Which became interesting, of course, because he created the first Air Force.
Did he really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when he was responsible for the colonies just after the war, one of the things he decided was that they might be able to reduce the number of troops in India. Remember, England was very much strapped for money at the time. Reduce expenditures, and one of the ways they would do that is by an Air Force, so that planes would try to keep track of what was going on, and whereas otherwise you'd need just huge numbers of men and big armies to do it. Yeah.
One thing that you corrected me on in our previous program on Churchill was that Churchill often gets the blame for what happened in World War I at Gallipoli.
Yes.
And you distinguish between Churchill's proper role as First Lord of the Admiralty and the battle, the naval battle in the Dardanelles, which was not successful at all.
Right.
And
right.
the decision of Kitchener and Hamilton to send troops up the slopes of Gallipoli against a dug-in Turkish force.
Right.
So the what was it that let's talk about the Dardanelles. Why did the Navy get deployed that far away from Western Europe?
Okay. Because very soon after the outbreak of war, the two sides ended up facing each other across a long line in Europe. And just throwing massive amounts of troops and shells back and
obscene waste of life.
Yeah, casualties, unbelievable casualties. And they're just doing it again and again and again. Churchill didn't want to do that. Churchill was always in favor of finding a way of diminishing the necessary casualties while at the same time winning. So he argued in both world wars that the way to do that was not to keep landing right in the middle of them and fighting it out, but finding a flank to turn. Well, once that line was set up, running, you know, from the Low Countries all the way down towards Italy, once that line was set up, the boundaries of it were so far away that you could either turn it in far north or far south.
We're talking about north in Belgium or south in France, right?
Right. And now Churchill wanted to go north, and he thought perhaps they could take an island off Germany and lead an attack from there. The island he had in mind, by the way, was Bork. And he tried very hard to get that. He was for the invasion of Norway in order to get that going. And that was a very active part of this, the first part of the war, in both world wars. But they couldn't go north in the First World War because they didn't have the ability to do it.
And then Germans had a very powerful navy, didn't they?
Yes. Yes, he had a hugely powerful navy. But see, its primary job was not fighting so much as blockading the Germans so that they couldn't get munitions and food and stuff of that sort. So they dominated the seas. That's what his main job was. And Churchill always argued, that's fine, they need to do that. But if there's a surplus of ship and men, we should use them to transport an army either to the north or south and attack from there so we can get around the lines and fight not directly the biggest large amounts of men, but fight a more successful maneuvering attack.
But why Turkey and not Calais or somewhere in southern France?
Well, because a couple of reasons. One of them was, remember that one of their allies, the British allies, was Russia. Okay, and Russia had trouble getting enough armaments to fight. And on the other end of that, the Allies had trouble feeding themselves. Well, Russia is a wheat country, so it wanted to get its wheat out. It wanted to get munitions in. So if they could get to the Russians that way, they could use that as a turning flank. Well, the way to do that was to get up through the Dardanelles and Bosphorus, the Black Sea, and make a connection with the Russians. That was the ultimate goal. Well, to do that, you had to fight the Turks. Turks originally tried to get the Turks to come in on the British side. They wouldn't do it. They were eventually on the German side, so that meant they had to fight to get through. But that was the purpose of it all. It was a flanking movement. And Churchill thought they could do it without such a huge loss of men. And they did, as a matter of fact. They didn't win. They pulled back when some ships were sunk by mines. But there was very little loss of life, very little loss of life. And I think most historians now look at it as a missed opportunity. Not that there's any guarantee they could have gotten through, of course. But it looked like they might have been able to. The forts were low on ammunition. The British had ordered some destroyers to be recast as minesweepers. And they were doing a lot of things to get through, but then that was called off. And when that was called off, they decided to attack Turkey by land, and that was Gallipoli. That was the battle for Gallipoli.
And so was the naval battle of the Dardanelles meant to be a precursor to an invasion of Gallipoli?
Well, at different times, it sometimes was seen as a precursor, but sometimes seen as a combined operation, and usually it was seen as a naval operation with troops coming in to take advantage of it if they were there. So Churchill spent a lot of time trying to get troops there. He got a number of them there, but everyone thought that what was really needed was the one solid division of the 29th Division, and Kitchener held that in his hands and wouldn't let it go until it was too late to really do anything with it. And Churchill really couldn't control that, and he didn't control the land battles at all.
Churchill to blame for the failure of that naval battle at the Dardanelles that was the invasion of Gallipoli?
No, not at all.
What happened?
What happened was that as they were going through, some ships struck some mines, and there was a loss of life. A French ship went down, a couple of British ships went down, and they were going to start the battle again the next day. The admiral in charge wrote back to Churchill, going full steam, head tomorrow, we'll get them. They never really did that, though. They kept waiting, and it's very confusing trying to figure out all the ins and outs of it, because what happened is the general commanding went on board the admiral, captain's ship there, but an admiral, and they had a discussion. No one's really sure exactly how that discussion went, but after that, it seemed like the operation was always conceived of as a combined operation with troops and ships. And the problem was that if the troops had been there earlier, they probably could have taken Gallipoli. But by Kitchener let them go, the Germans had reinforced the troops.
It was kind of like JFK deciding not to send in the planes and the Cuban.
And timing is very, very important in these things. And I think not enough attention sometimes is given to how important it is. Because the battle depends not only on what you've got, but what the other guy's got. And they had a real chance to get through, I think. And if they'd gotten through that, some people say, well, it wouldn't have done any good anyway. The Turks wouldn't have given up. Well, maybe they wouldn't have. But, in fact, the Turkish monarchy, however, moved out of the city of Constantinople. So there was a lot riding on this, and it looked very much like it might have been successful. We'll never know, because they never pushed it through by ships alone again. They tried sweeping the mines with these little converted wooden minesweepers, fishing boats, and couldn't do it that way, of course. And then they had to wait for the destroyers to be re-equipped as minesweepers. And then it got later and later and later, and they just never did it. And that's all the fighting switched the land fighting of Gallipoli.
What we're going to do, Jeff, is we're going to stop here. We're going to come back and do another show very soon, and we're going to pick up with Churchill actually going out on the Western Front, exposing himself to the trench warfare there, and we'll pick up the life of Winston Churchill from the First World War and then go forward to the Second World War. Jeff Wallen, thanks for being a guest once again on Church and Culture.
My pleasure, Deal.
By the next time we talk, I should have finished the great biography of Winston Churchill by Roy Jenkins.
Really is good, isn't it?
So you better be ready for me.
Oh, boy. So you'll be sitting there reading pages in October in some year.
There you go. And to all who are listening, we'll be back at this time on this day next week.
If you have any comments or questions about church and culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.